The owner of a Center City, Philadelphia building that killed six people after it collapsed in 2013 took the witness stand today. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. WHYY's Aaron Mosell reports that Richard Basciano's testimony at the ongoing civil trial marks the first time he's spoken publicly about the collapse.
In 2013, Richard Basciano owned a handful of commercial properties along Market Street near 22nd. It was the 91-year-old's dream to demolish them to make way for a glimmering mixed-use development known as the Gateway Project. On June 5, 2013, a freestanding three-story wall of a building under demolition collapsed onto and crushed a busy Salvation Army thrift store next door, killing six and injuring 13 more. Basciano told jurors he visited the site that morning but didn't see any demolition work or the wall fall. He said he was in the bathroom at the time of the collapse just before 11 a.m. The site's demolition contractor has said Basciano and his wife were facing the building then and saw the whole thing. Soon after the collapse, Basciano said he headed to an eye doctor's appointment. When asked if he fled the scene to avoid reporters and city officials, Basciano became angry, shouting that the assertion was a damn lie. Basciano's testimony continues tomorrow. I'm Aaron Mosell, WHYY News.
Today will go down as one of the darker days for Pennsylvania's public university system. At 5 this morning, as planned, the union representing faculty at 14 state-run schools went on strike. This is unprecedented territory for the Commonwealth, and no one knows when the 107,000 students affected by the walkout will be back in class. WHYY's Avi Wolfman Aaron visited one of the schools to survey the scene.
Westchester University sits on 390 well-manicured acres, about 45 minutes west of Philadelphia. On this morning, there were signs of normalcy, including maintenance of those manicured lawns. Westchester was officially open for business, and a few hardy students tried to attend their 8 a.m. classes. Junior Sydney Treeman arrived at her business writing seminar on time and flipped the lights on herself.
Usually there's about 25 to 30 kids in my class.
Today, the room was empty. Westchester told students to attend classes in case their professors crossed the picket line, but it seemed there were few cracks in union solidarity, and plenty of students left milling.
And I just hope they get a contract within the next few days, because there's been rumors about refunding the semester, and so far this has been my best semester, so I don't want to lose my grades.
No one really knows what will happen to the 107,000 students in the state's system of higher education. That's because a work stoppage of this magnitude is a first in the system's history. Could the strike drag on long enough to cancel the semester, delay graduations? It's all possible.
Contracts now! Fair! Contracts now! Fair!
So, how did we get here? Faculty members have been without a contract since mid-2015. The sides have bickered over many issues, but two are front and center: healthcare and salaries. The state system says it's offering raises across the board and the same healthcare plan all other university employees have. The union says proposed changes in health contributions amount to millions in givebacks. Mark Rimple heads the union's Westchester chapter.
The system believes not in give and take in negotiations, but just in take. And so we're really in a situation where it's all givebacks. And at the moment, we're still, you know, fighting for fairness.
The 14 schools in the state system are regional universities like Westchester, Cheney, Bloomsburg, and Kutztown. Penn State, Temple, and Pitt are not part of the coalition. Faculty strikes of this size aren't just rare in Pennsylvania, they're rare, period.
Very, very rare.
Richard Boris is recently retired, but for years he ran the Center for the Study of Collective Bargaining in Higher Education and the Professions at Hunter College. The severity of the situation in Pennsylvania may be notable, he says, but public systems around the country are facing major pressure. Just this year, in fact, New York and California nearly experienced major work stoppages of their own.
There's lava that is spewed from a very deep source. And the deep source is the 35 years of reduced spending on public universities and colleges.
And when state aid falls, schools don't have many options. They can hike tuition, or they can drive hard bargains with their staff. It's an unhappy choice, and today, it came with unhappy consequences. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
While Congress has stalled on raising the federal minimum wage above $7.25 an hour, 29 states have acted to boost workers' pay. That includes Delaware and New Jersey, but not Pennsylvania. Now, with both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump supporting raising the minimum, WHYY's Katie Culinary looks at how it could affect hundreds of thousands of residents in our region who are working and poor.
Hi, Vivi. Cool. You had a good day.
Heather Huff welcomes her fiancé's daughter, Bella, home from school with a big hug. Inside the boarding house in West Philadelphia where her family lives, Huff gives Bella a snack of potato chips and fruit punch, purchased with food stamps. Despite working since she was a teenager, the 33-year-old makes only $8 an hour at Arby's, just 75 cents above the minimum wage. Right now, Huff's biggest worry is whether she can continue paying $160 a month for the program where she's studying to become a medical assistant, a job that could earn her closer to $15 an hour. That kind of money, she says, could make a big difference.
I would have to be living in a rooming house. I wouldn't have to worry about sharing space with somebody else. My daughter would have to be able to play as she wants. I'd be able to provide, not live on state government assistance. I'd be able to go and finish school. It just, a lot of stress would be taken off my back.
Huff says one thing that helps her cope with that stress is participating in protests with other workers demanding a $15 minimum wage. 5-year-old Bella, who comes along to the rallies, grabs my microphone to show off the chants she learned.
I say we walk, we fight. For 15 on the chips, I say we work.
We sweat, put 15 on our chips. We work, we sweat, put 15 on our chips.
The Fight for 15 movement, backed by the Service Employees International Union, has been organizing protests in cities like Philadelphia throughout this election year. But neither of the presidential candidates is willing to go that far. Democrat Hillary Clinton wants to raise the minimum wage to $12 an hour at the national level and supports local efforts to push it even higher. Republican Donald Trump has said it should be $10 an hour, but thinks states should call the shots.
As an example, I live in New York. It's very expensive in New York. You can't buy a hot dog for the money you're talking about.
While Delaware and New Jersey have raised their minimum wages to more than $8 an hour, efforts in Pennsylvania are stalled. Bills introduced by Democrats have failed to gain traction with the Republican-controlled legislature. According to the Keystone Research Center, a liberal think tank, raising the minimum wage to $10.10 would help more than 1 million Pennsylvania workers. That includes more than 300,000 people in Philadelphia and the nearby suburbs. But critics argue it would actually put many of those workers out of a job because employers couldn't afford to pay them. Alex Halper is with the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry, which has lobbied against a higher minimum wage.
The jobs lost are the ones that are occupied by the very, low-income individuals that we're trying to help here.
This is something economists have argued about for decades.
You got real catfights and some pretty unpleasant ones.
Dale Bellman is a professor at Michigan State University who studies the effect of the minimum wage on jobs. He says today, most economists are no longer catfighting about whether or not the country should raise the minimum wage. Instead, they're arguing about how much is too much. After reviewing more than 200 academic papers on the issue, Bellman's found that modest increases in the minimum wage don't result in fewer jobs. Bellman thinks Trump's idea to raise it to $10 an hour is modest enough to avoid major job losses, but doesn't help low-income workers much.
Basically, Trump's proposing to restore the minimum wage to a level that we had in the 1960s. That's still above the buying power of the more recent minimum wage.
But given the fact it often takes Congress years to raise it again, Bellman says it's pretty low. Bellman says Clinton's proposal for a $12 an hour wage is reasonable, so long as it's phased in over several years. He thinks it could go farther to help workers in states like Pennsylvania, where lawmakers are deadlocked on the issue, and where state law bars local governments like Philadelphia's from setting their own minimum wages. Michelle Riggs makes $10.45 an hour as a security guard at Temple University. She says another $1.55 would help.
It'd be a start. Maybe I might could put $20 away.
She lives in South Philadelphia with her daughter and granddaughter, who help care for Riggs' 82-year-old mother, who owns the house. Riggs hasn't been able to afford a vacation in 7 years, but says she's getting by.
By my age, I'm looking forward to retiring. And I just feel bad for the people that's coming up, because I don't have 44 more years to work. But a lot of the young people, they come in there, they got 47 more years to work. Making this type of money, you don't have any money to retirement. You're going to have to work the rest of your life.
Riggs says she worries about her teenage granddaughter, who, after a long search, just got her first job at Wawa. She's making $10 an hour, just 45 cents less than her grandmother. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
In the lead up to the election, we've been looking at major issues on voters' minds, and you can hear other reports in our series, including the candidate's stance on fighting poverty and making childcare more affordable, at newsworks.org. This evening's forecast, partly cloudy skies, falling back to 59 degrees. Tomorrow, overcast, a 30% chance of stray showers, high near 76. Showers likely on Friday, otherwise cloudy, high 70 degrees. Rain, perhaps into Saturday morning, and then turning partly sunny, high 56. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. The presidential election this year has been extremely polarizing, so we sent WHYY's Joe Hernandez to a South Jersey town where the margins of victory in the last two presidential elections were razor thin, all to hear what voters there are thinking this year.
We can clear the starting lane, please. We're getting ready to start the race.
The 6th annual Mothers Matter 5K run took place on Sunday. It's sponsored by the Laura Rose Albert Foundation, which helps mothers lead better lives. But I was there because this race was taking place in Washington Township, about half an hour's drive from Philadelphia and home to 50,000 residents. It's a township that, politically speaking, is split right down the middle.
I'm not really thrilled about either of the candidates, honestly. So it's almost to the point where it's like anyone else besides these two. So,
Joe Wojciechowski lives in town, and he still hasn't decided whether he's voting for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump.
Feeling I don't have a good feeling about her. I'm not sure that I really feel that she would be a great leader for the country either. So I'm struggling with that, but I know that he would not be.
Washington Township is basically one big undecided voter. In the 2008 and 2012 presidential elections, about 25,000 Washington Township residents voted. And both times, the margin between Barack Obama and his Republican opponent was fewer than 250 votes. In 2008, that margin swung in Obama's favor. In 2012, a majority of voters picked Mitt Romney. And this year, residents again are feeling pulled between the two candidates.
Sadly, I think we're doomed no matter what. we are almost, we're out of, there are no candidates.
Tanya Hogan is originally from Washington Township, but now she lives in Camden County. At the beginning of the campaign, she says she thought Clinton and Trump had strong points, but now she's disillusioned with both, so much so that she doesn't even know if she'll vote next month.
I'm debating. I'll decide the morning of the election, absolutely. I feel it's important to vote, but right now I don't feel I have anybody to vote for.
But other voters at the race on Sunday had their minds made up, like Joe Powell from nearby Cherry Hill.
Well, I think the Clintons are crooks, perfectly honest. There's always a scandal around them, and they always get away with it.
Powell says Trump is a good alternative to Clinton, who strikes him as untrustworthy and elitist.
Because, you know, I'm not a college graduate. I know that you got to be a college graduate. That's, you know, like Clinton made fun of me. So, I don't need that.
Sherrill Jackson is a registered Democrat, but at first she wanted to support Trump.
He came in with just, I was like, oh, okay, not a politician. Let's try that. And then he came in with this really off the rails comments, like just
Jackson will be voting for Clinton. She says she doesn't like the way Trump talks about women and doubts whether he'll be able to get along with world leaders. Jackson's biggest takeaway this year, though, is how cutthroat the election has become and how that's trickled down into her daily life.
Oh my gosh, the Facebook, like I just kind of passed through it because it's really getting ugly. Like your own friends, my own family's, we got into this thing and I was like, I didn't call you names. I like, back off. It's like, it's real. It's ugly. It's, and I don't remember that ever being so. Everyone's like, yeah, I'm voting this, I'm voting that. Okay.
The presidential election will come to an end on November 8th, but the political divisions in Washington Township and nearby seem like they'll keep going for another campaign cycle. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
And this program reminder, stay with WHYY-FM and WHYY-TV tonight at 9 for live coverage of the third and final debate between presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. One of the best American painters of the 19th century was an early fan of photography. Thomas Eakins, famous for the Gross Clinic painting, caught the camera bug in 1880. From WHYY's Arts and Culture desk, Peter Crimmins reports that a new exhibition at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts shows how photography got the artist in trouble.
Thomas Eakins was 35 years old when he was hired by the Academy of the Fine Arts to teach drawing and painting. Almost immediately afterward, in 1880, he bought his first camera.
Eventually, he began to integrate it into his teaching methods, into his own production of art.
Curator Susan Danley says Eakins would start preparing a composition by first taking photographs of his subjects.
There are many photographs, for example, in the collection that seem to have filled the, oh, I suppose the spot in an artist's production that would have been done by sketches and drawings. He relied on the camera instead of the drawing.
Danley put together Thomas Eakins, photographer at the Academy. That's an institution which, in 1886, fired Eakins, in part because of his photography. Eakins strongly believed art students should learn figure drawing from nude models, an idea that was radical at the time, particularly for female students. It was too radical for the Academy. PAFA now has the largest collection of Eakins' photos, 650 images he took over 25 years. A majority of them are nudes. Danley says they were originally aids for painting, not to be exhibited or shared, but sometimes the nude subjects were his own students, and sometimes he would appear nude in the photos with them.
These were not photographs that he shared with the general public. He thought it was nobody's business what he did. He knew his photographs were taken in the aid of art and really didn't view them as pornography. They're certainly not really pornographic in any way, but they are troubling.
The exhibition also includes personal candid images of Eakins' friends, his wife Susan, his Irish setter Harry, and his horse Billy. He even took a picture of his horse and his wife, both nude. He never exhibited his photos as art, and scholars did not know they existed until 1985, 70 years after Eakins died, when they were donated to PAFA. They have never before been seen as their own exhibition. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight. We'll